The Siege of Vienna, 1683. The Relief Forces Approach, Part 1. Now, of course, Charles of Lorraine was working very hard. He had a handful of troops, but slowly reinforced by various German levies, whose assistance was rendered less useful by the jealousies of the sovereign princes in command. He was opposed both to the Turks and to Tilly. He was expected to be ready to support the garrisons of Pressburg and Komorn to hinder the incursions of the enemy into Upper Austria and into Moravia. Above all, to prepare the bridges above Vienna, by which alone a relieving army could arrive. Though driven by the Leopoldstadt Island and from all immediate communications with the city, his presence yet animated the besieged with hope of help. He fixed his headquarters finally at Krems on the Danube, where the Saxon contingent presently arrived, followed by the troops of the Circles and the Bavarians. Before their arrival, towards the end of August, Lorraine felt strong enough to advance and rescue Pressburg from Tilly. He followed up the operation by a defeat inflicted on the combined forces of the Turks and the Hungarians upon the march field. A detachment of 4,000 Polish horse under Lubromensky, originally raised to assist Tilly, were already present with the army of Lorraine. But the decisive operations were of necessity postponed until after the coming of the King of Poland with the bulk of his forces, and of course the rest of the German troops. The Duke of Lorraine in these moments undoubtedly proved his title to generalship. But nothing except the extraordinary apathy of the vizier rendered them possible. A skillful employment of the enormous force of Turkish cavalry would have forced the imperial army to retire for lack of supplies. The ravage aimlessly and mercilessly inflicted upon Austria and the confines of Moravia would, if directed against Poland, have probably prevented the march of Sobieski. An able commander with such forces at his command might have prevented or at least hindered the junction of the Polish army with the German army. Nor were any steps taken by the vizier to stop the construction of the bridges at Krems and Tulln, nor to guard the defiles of Wienerwald over which the Christian army must advance to raise the siege. So extraordinary indeed was the neglect by the Turks that a secret understanding has been supposed between Tilly and Sobieski, by which in return for the future good offices of the latter, the former was not to molest Poland nor hinder the junction of the Christian forces. Be that as it may, the secret information of the Poles was as good as that the Turks had was bad. The king knew thoroughly with what foe he had to deal. Sobieski had left Warsaw for Krakow on July the 18th. Up to the last moment, the Turks disbelieved he was coming in person, and the emperor and the French kings both doubted it as well. After all, Sobieski was gouty, he was rheumatic, he was too fat to ride. Such was the tenor of the information of the baffled French, the French agent Vitry. Nevertheless, on August the 22nd, Sobieski was on the Silesian frontier with the main part of his army. It consisted mostly of cavalry, of those Polish horsemen that were matchless in prowess. His infantry was less numerous and inferior, their shabby accoutrements contrasting sharply with the gaudy equipment of the cavalry. "They have sworn to dress themselves better in the spoils of the enemy," the king said to one regiment. His march lay through Silesia and Moravia, through the borders of lands devastated by the Tartars, where the trembling inhabitants thronged around him, hailing him already as their deliverer. Urged by message after message from Lorraine, he left his army to follow under the leadership of Field Marshal Jablonski and hurried on himself at the head of 2,000 cavalry and his son Prince James by his side. Now, we can follow every movement of the campaign from Sobieski's letters, which amid the hurry of the march during short hours would snatch some sleep once at least during the thunder of a Turkish cannonade. He did find time to dispatch continually to his queen, as he calls her. Her letters in reply are his continual consolation amid the labors of the campaign, the ingratitude of the emperor, and the insubordination of his subjects. Quote, "I read all of your letters, my dear and incomparable Maria, thrice over, once and I receive them, once when I retire to my tent and am alone with my love, and once when I sit down to answer them. On August the 29th, he writes from near Brunn in Moravia, sending the news of the retreat of Tekle after his defeat by Lorraine, and adding that he hopes that the next day, on nearing the Danube, to bear the cannon, which tells us that Vienna is still not taken. On the 31st, he is near Thuln, above Vienna. He has passed the distant thunder of the cannonade upon his left hand and has expected his junction with the army of Lorraine. Despairing of the arrival of the Lithuanians, he has distributed the arms intended for them among the imperfectly equipped Poles. Still more, he is distressed at the non-appearance of the Cossacks, whom he expected and whom he knew was invaluable for outpost duty. Mezininsky, who should have conducted them, was simply lingering at Lemberg. Most interesting of all is the passage in which he gives his wife his first intention of their future colleague, the Duke of Lorraine. Lorraine has been a competitor with Sobieski for the crown of Poland, and must have been a singular meeting when the rivals first came face to face, cooperating together in this mighty enterprise. Sobieski the king, whose offsprings were not to reign, Charles the Duke, the destined ancestor of the imperial line of Austria. The friendship of the former rivals was cemented by a banquet. Lorraine himself was induced to proceed from his native Mosul. Besides Lorraine, Sobieski found a crowd of German princes awaiting his arrival. John George of Saxony, speaking no French nor Latin, and very little German. Waldeck, the house of Waldeck Wildingen, of a family, not an ancestor of the present Duchess of Albany. William III's right-hand man in the Netherlands, here commanding the troops of the Circles, and winning high praise from the king for his activity and zeal. Maximilian of Bavaria, whose courage and ill fortune were hereafter to be signalized at Blenheim and Ramallis, now aged 21, wins notice as better dressed than the others. There were two Württembergers, the Prince of Brunswick-Lüneburg, afterwards George I, the Prince of Saxe-Lauenburg, Hohenzollern and Hessian, three princes of Anhalt, Hermann, and Louis of Baden. The latter was with Marlborough at Schellenberg. Two sons of Montecuculi, the conqueror of St. Gothard. The last and youngest, though not the least, Eugene of Savoy, the future conqueror of Zenta and Belgrade, and the colleague of Marlborough in his greatest battles. There was Count Leslie of the Scotch House, which had given generals to half the armies of Europe. Count Taaffe, the Irishman, afterwards Sir Francis Taaffe, the Earl of Carlingford, whose elder brother fell fighting for King James at the Boyne, but whose service to the Allies secured the earldom from forfeiture. There were gathered veterans of the 30 Years' War, men who might have seen Gustavus Adolphus or Wallenstein, and men who were to reap their highest laurels hereafter in the wars of the Spanish Succession. As was wittily said, the empire would have been there had only the emperor been present. The Brandenburg troops were also wanting. The great elector was jealous of Poland, once his superior in the Prussian duchy, had formerly been injured by Sobieski, acting with the Swedes in the interest of France, and moreover was not on the best terms with the emperor. Brandenburg then, as ever, was playing the skill and patience her own game. The fortune of the future Prussian monarchy was not to be lightly risked for the sake of Austria. But the emperor himself must not be rashly charged with a want of courage for his absence from the camp. He was not trained the war. The presence of his court would have been embarrassing to the operations, perhaps would have been inseparable from intrigues and jealousies that would seriously have crippled the army. A certain stubborn manhood Leopold had shown in not yielding to the pressure put upon him to make terms with Louis XIV in this extremity. The aid of France could have been purchased by the election of the Dauphin as the King of the Romans, probably by smaller sacrifices. The Diet at Ratisbon had not been disinclined to yield, but the Emperor had steadfastly refused to subject either his own house or the Empire to French dictation. That one crown to head was in the field was of the greatest importance, especially when that one was the King of Poland. So we have quite a list of interesting commanders. Frequently, when you study this period, there is the emphasis on Sobieski, and there's no question that the Polish army is definitely the most important, certainly the most charismatically led when compared to the younger men of tremendous charisma. Eugene of Savoy, for example. the Duke of Lorraine has this mass of excellent generals with great experience. All they have to do is get to Vienna on time. So we'll see how they advance next time. The sources for this, Bulwark of Christendom by Schimmel, Great Sieges by Meligari, Enemy at the Gates by Wheatcraft, Sword and Scimitar by Ibrahim, and The History of the Ottoman Empire by Howard. So hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com. Ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.